I've been working on a really quite remarkable collection of English healing and protective charms. And this work has brought me into the path of an incredibly diverse set of very interesting people. I've worked with neo-pagan healers, I've worked with biomedical doctors, I've worked with professors of anthropology, with the Museum of Witchcraft in Cornwall, and with fine artists. And there's a couple of things I want to draw from this very, very rich process and share with you now. And the first is that when these charms were collected, the two men who collected them, they didn't have to look very hard to find them. They were everywhere. These charms were enormously ubiquitous. The other thing is that we have very particular sorts of charms, particularly a whole stone, that are occurring in different sites across England. And people are using these charms right up to the mid-20th century, and some people, of course, still use these kind of charms today. So it's something that comes up to the present day, and something that also probably stretched back millennia. So these things are very particularly English. They're very inherent to Englishness. I'd say there's as English as having milk in your tea. The other thing about these charms is that they're universal. So people will always, and have always, put great power into objects. If we look at the Horniman collections, we've got hundreds, if not thousands, of cultures represented. And we find charms occurring again and again and again. And I go as far as to say, I'm going to put it out there, that there's never been a culture that hasn't used charms. So these charms are very particular. They're very particular to England. But also, they're universal. They're something that links England and Englishness to every culture that's ever been. Now I'm going to tell you something more useful, which is what's going to happen. So, ahead of us we have 40 minutes of talks and presentations. Each presentation will take 10 minutes, and at the end we'll have 20 minutes for any questions you might have from any of the speakers or presenters, and also to come and look at our collection of charms with me and my colleagues, and if you have any questions for us about our charms or about the museum generally, we'd be more than happy to answer them. So I'm not going to introduce the speakers. I've really enjoyed hearing them speak, and I feel really honoured to have them here. I'm just going to welcome our first speaker for the third time, Philip Cargon.
Hello, hello. So I've written a book called The Book of English Magic, and I also lead the Order of Bards, Ovates and Druids. And in that capacity, I have to use a magic wand. It's part of the job description, which is why I've been asked to come and talk to you about wands today. Now, you might think, when you first think of magic wands, you might think that these come from the world of fantasy and children's fiction. But what I want to explain to you today is how very real they are and how they have been used for thousands of years. If we go back to the site of the oldest ritual burial in Western Europe, we would find ourselves moving towards the Gower Peninsula in southern Wales. And we'd come to a small valley called the Dragon's Teeth Valley. And there you'll find jagged stones sticking up out of the ground that you have to very carefully negotiate your way through. When you get there, you find that that valley has protected an extraordinary cave that looks out onto the Irish Sea. And there, in 1823, bones were discovered. And those bones were covered in red ochre. At first it was thought it was a woman, and so the bones were named the Red Lady of Paviland. Later on they discovered that the bones were actually of a man. But the Red Lady of Paviland had, in addition to the bones, there were mammoth tusk ivory wands that were broken. And some archaeologists believe that the reason why they were broken is that they were done as a magical act. That as the spirit left the body and they were recognizing that, they also snapped the wands of this shaman, this magician, to release the magical power that was contained in the wands so that they could travel with him and he could work with them in the other realms. Wind the clock forward 34,000 years to 2016, and some of you may have been at the British Museum at the Celts exhibition. How many? Can we have a show of hands? How many people went there? Not very many. Not very many. This is you're a different lot from the other two lots. In the other two lots, like about half the people have been to the exhibition. This is the, sort of the party lot, I think. Later at night. Well, in that exhibition, there was an extraordinary magic wand. It was absolutely massive. It was about this long. It had, at the point, it had a crystal ball. It had dragons twisting around it. And it's used in the Royal Welsh National Eisteddfod. And so you see, in Wales, the wand being used today and the wand being used 34,000 years ago. But it's also used today amongst ordinary folk. In fact, people in this room might possibly be owners of magic wands and users of magic wands. Are you prepared to declare yourself? Put your hand up if you have or use a magic wand, if that's okay. One, two. Oh, yes, it's a different crowd. Three, yes. The previous ones have been, you know, a dozen or so people who had wands. Okay, I'm going to show you two wands wanted to come and say hello to you. One is a very simple wand. It's quite shy. It lives in this little covering. And it's a simple wand. And you'll see it here. But as I selected this, I was only going to bring this one. But then from the corner of my room, another much more flamboyant, much more extroverted wand said, I want to come too. And I said, well, you're not really a wand, you're a staff. And he said, well, yes, I know, but we share many of the similar functions and we do similar things. So in the end, I agreed. And I brought him along. Oh, yes. So this is made of yew wood, an antler from Sussex, and a staff performs many of the same functions of the wand. Well, what are they, you might be saying to yourself? Well, It's a wand is used to direct power. It's used to cast a magic circle. It's used to ward off unwanted influences. It's used to invoke spirits or heavenly powers, if you like, energies. It's used for all these things. And you find the wand actually occurring in disguise, in some of its functions, in the everyday world. You see that in the conductor's baton. You see it in the scepter of the monarch, this idea of direction and of power and of authority. You see it in the field marshal's baton. And in the Third Reich, they had seven different kinds of baton that were used. And Hermann Göring, in charge of the Luftwaffe, was given a baton with 600 jewels, 600 diamonds encrusted in it. So they sort of were working with this power of symbolic authority and so on. Didn't do them much good, of course, luckily. And then you have you have the headmaster's cane, you have black rod in the House of Lords. So these all symbolise power, authority, and direction, in contrast with that other magical implement, which is the cauldron or the chalice, which contains and nurtures. So much for the uses of the wand and the symbolism of the wand. But how exactly do you go about finding one or making one? Well, wands are almost always made of wood. Not always, but almost always made of wood. And so wands naturally go well together with druids, because the word druid actually means wood sage, lover of trees, lover of the forest. And so the first thing to do, if you want a wand, is to choose what kind of wood you're going to have and use. And different woods have different qualities. If you want to work with divination, you would use hazel, for instance. If you want to work with travelling in the different realms of the upper, middle and lower worlds, you would use ash or birch. If you wanted to work with the mysteries of time and the ancestors, you would use yew. If you wanted to work with tradition, you would use oak. If you wanted to work with research, you'd use beech and so on. The actual time that you found your wand and made it might be significant too. People who are really into this go into casting horoscopes and working out exactly when. There's a wonderful book called Wand Lore by Alfierian Gwydion MacLear, which is the manual on creating a wand and making a wand. If you're really lucky, you ask to receive a wand, and when you're walking through the forest, a piece of wood will magically fall from a tree. And this has happened to people. I've heard stories from people where it's just at the right moment it appears. Then you have to determine the size, and then you have to decide whether you're going to have a simple wand, like the one I showed you, or whether you're going to have a wand that has all four components of a pommel, a handle, a shaft, and a point. The pommel is the reservoir of magical energy, which is at the base of the wand, and that might be formed of a crystal or of a stone or carved out of the wood. And the idea is that's where the magician stores the energy. And then the handle, the next part of the wand, is where the wand connects with you as the magician. Because in a way, a wand is just an extension of the hand. And if you ever find yourself in an emergency without your wand, you don't need to worry, because all you have to do is use your hand. And the hand can be just as effective. And so through the handle flows the energy, perhaps from the pommel. It flows along, also from you as a being. It's all about opening, I think, to higher forces and energies that flow through you, and the wand helps to direct it. It goes along the shaft, which you may carve with symbols or spells, to the point. And then when you come to the point, you choose whether to form it as a blade, or whether to carve it as a point, or whether to have a crystal or a stone at the end of it. And then there's a whole art of choosing which crystal and so on. And so this, in brief, is the way that somebody might work to create a wand. And you might be tempted to ask, well, do we really need wands? And I think the answer to that is this. Do we need myth? Do we need fantasy? Do we need imagination? Do we need magic? And the answer, I think, is yes, we do, very much so in the world today. So, thank you.